And who taught him that lesson? Bethany Waits. How old was he when Bethany arrived? She was a researcher first, so maybe 2008. Wikipedia will tell you that Mike Waghorn was 56 in 2008, but he was 61. Bethany would have been early 20s, he supposes, down from Leeds with a media studies degree of all things. She would make him tea. He would tell her what a waste of time a media studies degree was. She would bring him stories her more experienced colleagues had missed. He would buy her a pint after work. She would challenge him, goad him, encourage him, and he would make sure she got safely into a taxi at the end of the night. A year or so in, Mike told Bethany she should be appearing on air. Bethany typically did not disagree with this assessment, so she started filming reports. Then, every now and again, she'd pop into the studio to discuss those reports. Then, when Mike's co-host was on an ill-advised holiday, Bethany would step in, and before you knew it, Mike and Bethany were the team at Southeast Tonight. One evening, they had been having a pint near the studio, as they often did, and there was a copy of Kent Matters on the bar. It was a local magazine, just photos from events, adverts for spas, and expensive houses, that sort of thing. There had been a picture of Mike in the magazine. He was looking very suave, wearing a tux at some business event or other, the Kent Accountancy Awards, maybe. He remembered that one because he had fatally mispronounced the name of the awards very early on and had the crowd firmly on his side from there on. He had taken Pauline as his plus one, as he often did in those days. She liked to drink, and he liked having someone else to talk to other than an accountant from Sevenoaks, who hadn't heard of him but demanded a selfie nonetheless. Bethany had pointed the picture out, his arm around Pauline's waist, and Mike had smiled and told her about the Kent accountancy slip-up. Bethany then began the long process of making Mike a better, happier man. "You should have been there with your boyfriend," she had said. Very matter-of-fact, bag of peanuts torn open and spatchcocked on the table in front of her. Mike can see it and hear it now. They had another pint. And another. And another. Mike had never really spoken about being gay before. Not openly, in a pub with a colleague. He was old enough to have kept his sexuality hidden, a rolled-up secret in a deep pocket. It had never seen the light of day before. And why? Well, 100 reasons, 1,000 reasons, but those reasons were all tied together with a knot of shame. And it was that knot that Bethany began to unpick. Bethany refused to let Mike feel shame. She was from a different generation, a generation Mike envies. He sees them sometimes out on the streets. He is certain they have their vulnerabilities and their insecurities, and they certainly still have many fights. But the joy with which they choose to present themselves, it makes Mike so proud and so jealous all at once. The process wasn't quick, and the process wasn't easy, but Bethany was by his side throughout. Mike came out to friends. He came out to colleagues. He remembers telling Pauline for the first time. He was very serious, very solemn, as he told her his secret. Pauline gave him a huge hug and just said, "At last, my love, at last." Mike sometimes wonders why Pauline hadn't been the one to confront him, but again, different generations. Mike has never officially come out to the public, although they could find out if they really wanted, and he still goes to events with Pauline from time to time, but also with Steve or Greg or any of the other men he has managed to grasp but not hold. And bit by bit, he recognised that he was changing. He still looked amazing, sure, still wore the suits and the hairspray and flirted with the women, but he had started to become himself, to be authentic and to be real. And what do you know? Happiness followed. He became a better man, a better friend, a better colleague, a better presenter. If ITV had filmed their pilot now, Mike would get the job without doubt. The irony being that Mike wouldn't want it anymore. Southeast Tonight was no longer where Mike Waghorn hid. It was where he flourished. The building society robberies, the bouncy castles, and the 25-year-old cats. He reported because he cared about himself and about his community. Mike had Bethany to thank for that. Was he still an idiot at times? Sure. Could he still be difficult? Yes, particularly when hungry. But he could look himself in the mirror without turning away. Mike takes another swig of cider. He is waiting for the boxing to come on and is currently having to sit through endless adverts for gambling companies. One of them is presented by Ron's son, Jason Ritchie. A fine fighter he was. Mike got the text from Pauline an hour or so ago. They start digging for the body tomorrow. Digging for Bethany's body. His wonderful, talented, headstrong friend. She could have done anything. She could have been anything. The world would have known her name. Bethany saved Mike's life, and Mike was never able to repay that debt in her lifetime. But he could repay it now, with the help of the Thursday Murder Club. Find her killer, bring her peace. Heather Garbutt, Jack Mason, someone they have yet to consider? Mike feels he is about to find out. And that is the least he could do for Bethany Waits. Chapter 63. Heather Garbutt's home is on an ugly road with a pretty name. To the front, there is a driveway lined with hedges, now overgrown, that bends away from the road, hiding the house from the traffic. You could drive past this spot every day and never see the slow decline of a once handsome house. To the back there is a garden and then woodland, separating it from a municipal golf course. The house itself is a bungalow. It had been pleasant enough at one point. They looked up the estate agent's pictures of the last time it had sold on Rightmove. Four beds, big sitting room overlooking the garden, a kitchen that the estate agent said was in need of modernization, but which Joyce rather liked. Perhaps not the house of someone rich, but the house of someone who worked with someone rich, comfortable in every sense. It had been listed at £375,000, though a quick house price search revealed that Jack Mason had paid £425,000 for it. He was clearly a motivated buyer, as Joyce supposes she would be if there were evidence that could send her to prison buried in the garden. The whole place is running wild now. Jack Mason might have bought it, but it seems he doesn't visit it. Ron had rung Jack last night to see if he could give them the keys, but Jack wasn't answering. Is he already regretting telling Ron and Victor about the body? He hadn't named his co-conspirator, but other than that, he had come dangerously close to grassing. Ron knows that won't have come naturally. And if they do find something, what will that mean for Jack? Two constables force open the door, pushing it unwillingly back against a pile of mail. Who is still delivering mail? Joyce wonders. Who takes a look at this house, clearly abandoned, returning to nature, and delivers a pizza leaflet? Joyce sees a National Trust magazine on top of the pile. She suspects she might have rather liked Heather Garbutt. Elizabeth has gone around the side of the building with Chief Constable Andrew Everton, but Joyce goes through the front door because she wants to be nosy. And the lovely thing about investigating a murder is that you can be nosy and call it work. Joyce is disappointed that there is not much to see, however. All traces of Heather Garbutt are gone. The only clue she was ever here are the paler squares of wallpaper where pictures had once hung. At least there is no need to be careful, to tiptoe round and not touch. Joyce has free rein. The house had been searched many years ago, and any evidence there might have been here is long gone. But no one had searched the garden. Why would you? With a body washed out to sea, what was there to dig for? Joyce walks into the sitting room, lovely patio doors framing the view of a large yellow digger, police tape flapping, and Chief Constable Andrew Everton in a peaked cap and a high-vis jacket, taking command of the scene. One of the constables slides open the doors and Joyce walks out onto the patio decking. Joyce watches her step. Decking gets too slippery. You are so much better off with stone. She has to admit, though, that this decking looks in better shape than the rest of the overgrown garden and fading house. The digger has been here since 8 this morning. The garden, and even bits of the woodland beyond, are pocked with holes. Two men in hard hats are just beginning to dismantle the decking. Tiny coloured flags mark where holes have been dug and where they are yet to be dug. Joyce spots Elizabeth. She is, surprise, surprise, monopolising the chief constable. "What a lot of holes," says Joyce. "And I was right about that kitchen. Even now it's very livable. Lots of storage." "The holes are not all ours," says Andrew Everton. "Someone, let's assume Jack Mason, has been doing their own digging over the years, especially as you get into the woods." Joyce looks into the woodland behind the garden. There are uniformed officers digging with shovels. "That's a lot of police officers," she says. "I'm the chief constable," says Andrew Everton. "People tend to jump when I ask for something. I'm told the only skeleton we have found so far was a guinea pig's." "We were digging in Vladivostok once," says Elizabeth. "I forget why. A warlord had buried something or other. Anyway, we uncovered a prehistoric moose, intact, antlers and all. We were all set to fill the hole back in, but the head of the Russian service at the time was on the board of the Natural History Museum, and in the end, we released a Russian spy from Belmarsh prison in return for the moose. It's on display if you go there now." "Right," says Andrew Everton. "You stop listening after a while," says Joyce. "She's always digging something up or upsetting Russia. Do you believe Jack Mason's story about the partner?" Andrew Everton considers the question. "It's an unusual thing to make up, and if he's lying, he's lying for a reason, and I wouldn't mind finding out what that reason is." "Any news back on Heather Garbutt's death?" asks Elizabeth. "Any forensics?" Andrew Everton shrugs. "Here's the thing about dusting a prison cell for fingerprints. There are hundreds of them, and most of them belong to people with criminal records." Elizabeth snorts. "Honestly, ignore her," says Joyce. A woman enters the garden from the side of the house. She wears white coveralls and plastic sleeves over her shoes. Forensics, just what Joyce has been looking for. She will let her settle and then go and speak to her. It never hurts to ask, does it? There is activity in the woodland, and a constable in muddied uniform runs out towards them from the trees. "Sir," says the constable, "we've found something." Andrew Everton nods. "Good work." He turns to Elizabeth and Joyce. "You two, stay here." This time, they both snort. Chapter 64. "I don't know if there has ever been so much testosterone in this room," says Ibrahim, as he carries in a tray of sweet mint tea for everyone. Victor and Henrik are at the dining table, hunched over the financial documents from Heather Garbutt's trial. Ron is sitting on the sofa watching something on his phone, and Alan is looking out of the window, wondering when Joyce might be back. Occasionally, he spots someone who might look a bit like her and gets excited. "Five boys," says Ibrahim, pouring the tea. "Henrik, how is your murderous rage? Subsided?" It is forgotten, says Henrik. It was tactically naive.
You fellows found anything? Asks Ron.
Nothing, says Victor. Thought Henrik was the best money launderer in the world.
I am, says Henrik. That is provable.
Well, Bethany Waits found something in there that you're missing, says Ron.
And it got her killed, says Ibrahim.
So, at the moment, you're just a guy with a beard.
Ron, Henrik is a guest, says Ibrahim.
A guest, says Ron, still not looking up from his phone. Yesterday he wanted to kill Joyce and now he's a guest.
And he wanted to kill me too, says Victor.
Guys, it was an error, says Henrik. I wanted to be tough. I cannot keep apologizing.
No need to apologize if you find out who killed Bethany Waits, says Ron.
We will find out, says Henry.
Did Bethany Waits say anything to anyone, asks Victor, about what she'd found?
No, says Ron.
Nothing about Karen Whitehead or Robert Brown, MSc.
Nothing about anyone, says Ron, far as we know.
Henrik, you rich enough to buy a football club?
I already own one, says Henrik.
Ibrahim sits at the dining table.
Well, she did say something to someone.
What did she say? Asks Victor.
She sent a message to Mike Waghorn, says Ibrahim, a couple of weeks before she disappeared.
Do you have the message? It might be important, asks Victor.
I don't think there is anything in it, says Ibrahim. But we could ask Pauline to ask Mike.
They're both coming over for lunch in a bit, says Ron.
You are taken with Pauline, Ron, says Victor.
Well, you're taken with Elizabeth, says Ron.
I know, says Victor, but I have no chance. You have every chance. What luck.
Ron shrugs, a little embarrassed.
We're friends.
Love is very precious, says Victor, and takes a sip of his mint tea.
I wonder if I could ask you to put a lace doily under your teacup, says Ibrahim, to prevent the wood from marking.
Could I use your bathroom? Asks Henrik. I forgot to moisturize this morning and I can feel myself drying out.
Ron looks at Ibrahim.
So much testosterone in one room, mate.
So much testosterone. Alan barks at a chaffinch.
Chapter 65. They found the gun wrapped in a pale blue cloth, buried about 30 feet or so into the woodland. Elizabeth had taken a look before it had been driven away for examination. When she heard the word gun, she had expected a revolver, some sort of handgun at least, but this was an assault weapon, semi-automatic. Andrew Everton looked as surprised as she did. It was a hell of a gun. There was no ammunition, but there was a metal box, which looked to contain around £100,000 or so in cash. So perhaps they had found the murder weapon and finally some of the proceeds of the scam. Time and forensics would tell. The forensic officer on scene should presumably be heading back fairly soon, but is currently being monopolized by Joyce. They are sitting together on Joyce's raincoat, which has been spread over a mossy bench. What they are talking about, heaven only knows. Elizabeth is walking out of the woods with Andrew Everton.
Seems like you owe us one, says Elizabeth.
I'll owe you one when we find Bethany's body, says Andrew Everton. We'll start concentrating the search in the same spot.
Feels like it should be enough to arrest Jack Mason, says Elizabeth. Ask him a few questions.
Leave that with me, says Andrew Everton. You can't do everything.
That was a moot point, but Elizabeth doesn't feel the need to argue.
Do keep us informed, though.
Andrew Everton bows to her a little sarcastically for Elizabeth's liking. Mom. Elizabeth veers off in the direction of Joyce and the forensic officer. She hears Joyce's conversation as she approaches.
But say that three bodies are left in a cellar for many years, Joyce is saying. At what stage would the smell disappear? Is Joyce asking her about the case in Rye?
Do they have wounds? Asks the forensic officer.
They have been dismembered by a chainsaw, says Joyce.
That doesn't sound like the case in Rye.
Well, they would bleed out very quickly, says the forensic officer, so putrefaction would also occur fairly quickly. The smell would be awful for the first, let's say, 2 months, then gradually things would return to normal.
Bit of Febreze every now and again, says Joyce. Elizabeth reaches the bench and addresses the forensic officer.
Is my friend bothering you? She does that sometimes.
Not at all, says the FO. I'm helping her with her story.
With her story?
Elizabeth takes a look at Joyce, who won't meet her gaze.
I thought I might give it a try, says Joyce to the flower bed. You know I like to write.
Three bodies in a cellar, says Elizabeth. That sounds familiar.
You're allowed to base things on real cases, says Joyce. Andrew Everton does it all the time.
Where do the chainsaws come in?
You have to add bits of your own too, says Joyce.
And you added chainsaws?
Joyce nods and gives a little smile.
Elizabeth wonders, not for the first time, just how well she knows her friend.
Shall we head home and see how the boys are getting on, says Elizabeth, and tell them we've found a gun?
Chapter 66. Pauline and Mike have arrived for lunch. Alan literally can't believe his luck. Even more people. If only Joyce were here, the whole scene would be perfect. Surely she won't be much longer. Pauline is tickling his belly as Mike Waghorn takes a seat.
This is Henrik, says Ibrahim. He is a cryptocurrency entrepreneur and Swede.
Mike holds his hands together and says, Namaste, Henrik.
Henrik is also very good with money laundering, says Ibrahim. And this is Victor, a former KGB colonel.
Pauline has told me a lot about you, Victor, says Mike.
Oh, has she now? Says Ron, and Pauline blows him a kiss.
It's good to meet you, Mike Waghorn, says Victor. I will confess that 2 weeks ago I hadn't known who you were, but I am now very familiar with your work. Though often I don't catch everything you're saying because Joyce likes to keep up a running commentary through the local news.
Any news on the search? Asks Mike. Still waiting, says Ron.
Pauline told him that Mike had taken news of the garden search very badly. It was such an extraordinary story. The body buried as blackmail. The killer some unknown accomplice. Mike wants the murder to be solved, but it will be very final for him.
You arrive at an opportune moment, however, says Ibrahim. Do you have the text of your message from Bethany to hand about the new information? Victor and Henrik would like to hear it in full. Perhaps it might unlock something.
Mike takes out his phone and scrolls until he finds the message. He addresses Victor and Henrik.
Skipper, some new info. Can't say what, but it's absolute dynamite. Getting closer to the heart of this thing.
Victor nods.
She would call you Skipper normally. No clue there? Completely normal, says Mike.
And she would say info instead of information, asks Henrik. It was normal for her to be informal.
It was usually emojis and swear words, to be honest, says Mike. Now, when she says...
Alan starts jumping at the window and barking hysterically, as if he simply cannot begin to comprehend what he has just seen. Victor rolls off his chair and crouches behind a sofa with his gun drawn. Mike raises one eyebrow. Henrik takes a moment and then taps Victor on the shoulder.
Victor, he says, you have to stop doing this. I'm the one who is trying to kill you, and I'm here.
Victor thinks for a moment, then accepts the truth of this observation and puts the gun down the back of his trousers.
I'm glad I didn't try to kill you, says Henrik, looking at the gun. You should be glad, says Victor, taking his seat once again. I would be throwing your body off a North Sea ferry round about now.
Ibrahim has buzzed his door open, and Elizabeth and Joyce walk into the room. Alan leaps at Joyce, and she gives him a cuddle.
Anything? Asks Mike.
No body, says Elizabeth. Not yet, but Jack Mason said there would be a gun. And there was a big one.
Was it the murder weapon? Asks Ibrahim.
Yes, Ibrahim, it was, says Elizabeth. The police handed me the gun, and I completed a full forensics check on it in the taxi on the way back.
Ibrahim turns to Mike. She is being sarcastic. Mike thanks him.
We will know soon enough, says Elizabeth.
And they found money, too, says Joyce. They think around 100,000, just buried in a tin.
Andrew Everton thinks they have enough to bring Jack Mason in, says Elizabeth. Money and a gun in his back garden might be enough to get him to talk. Tell us who buried them there.
Good luck with that, says Ron.
Henrik has been ignoring this conversation, tapping away at his computer.
Okay. I have something. The room turns to him as one, and he blushes.
Well, maybe I have something. I knew you'd come in handy, says Elizabeth. Spit it out, and we'll decide if it's something or not.
Mike, says Henrik. In her message, Bethany says that her news is absolute dynamite. Did she like to play little tricks?
It amused her to fool me from time to time, let's say that, agrees Mike.
Because what she found wasn't absolute dynamite, says Henrik. It was absolute dynamite.
Absolute dynamite, says Mike.
Very early in the money trail, £115,000 is paid into an absolute construction in Panama, says Henrik. That money is still there, as far as I'm able to tell, which is actually quite far because I'm very good at this sort of thing.
Not so good at killing pensioners, says Joyce, and gets a
hear, hear from Victor.
When absolute construction is set up, it seems that a web of subsidiary companies is set up beneath it, but no money was ever paid into them. So we have ignored them up to now. There is an absolute demolition, an absolute cement, an absolute scaffolding, and in Cyprus, a company called
Absolute Dynamite, says Ron. Elizabeth looks round her. She puts a hand on Mike's shoulder.
And when you look into Absolute Dynamite, you find two named directors, says Henrik.
One is our old friend Karen Whitehead, so that doesn't really lead us anywhere, but finally we have a new name. The other director is a Michael Gullis.
Michael Gullis, says Elizabeth. Pauline? Mike? Anything?
They look at each other, then back at Elizabeth, and shake their heads.
There was a Michael Gilkes who played for Reading, says Ron, midfielder.
Thank you, Ron,
says Elizabeth. Pauline taps Ron's hand. The room falls quiet once again, save for the tip-tapping of Henry's keyboard and Alan's happy panting as he moves from person to person to receive his due attention.
Elizabeth, says Joyce, I don't suppose you could join me outside for a moment.
Elizabeth gestures that she certainly could, and they wander out to Ibrahim's hallway.
Ask me, says Joyce.
Ask you what? Says Elizabeth.
Ask me if I know the name Michael Gullis, says Joyce.
Chapter 67. The team digging up the garden at Heather Garbutt's old house had dug up the gun this afternoon. They were still digging now under the searchlights as evening turned to night. Andrew Everton thought they had enough evidence at least to talk to Jack Mason. Chris and Donna had got the call.
You were so good again, I mean it, says Chris, reviewing Donna's latest appearance on Southeast Tonight.
She had discussed online fraud and flirted with a vicar who was in the studio raising money for a ramp. Chris thinks about overtaking someone on a blind bend, then remembers it's the dead of night and he's a police officer.
You just have to be yourself, says Donna. Ignore the cameras.
I've never been good at being myself, says Chris. I wouldn't know where to start.
Mum says you cried last night when you were watching Sex and the City.
I did, agrees Chris.
Well, don't start there, says Donna.
Chris especially loves his forward focus. Now there are no empty crisp packets in the footwell. He even had a shampoo the other day. Was that being himself?
How is Jack Mason going to take it, do you reckon? Asked Chris.
An assault rifle and $100,000 is tough to talk your way out of.
He's a pro, says Donna. He'll be charming. It'll be tougher for him if they find Bethany's body.
He'll walk away, says Chris. Don't you think? Doesn't matter if he owns the property. There'll be no forensic evidence after all this time.
I saw this Polish film where they dug up a body after 30 years or something, and a tattoo had imprinted itself on a leg bone, says Donna.
You've been to see a Polish film? Chris asks.
It's left here, says Donna.
They had given up on the sat-nav some time ago. Jack Mason's house was on a private road, leading off a private estate, leading off a small track, leading off a country road, deliberately hard to find, especially in this pitch darkness. As they take wrong turn after wrong turn, Chris thinks it would be easier to approach by boat and climb the cliff face. Also, Jack Mason would be able to see anyone approaching from a mile away. Has he seen the lights of the yellow Ford Focus yet? Is he waiting for them? Does he know what's in store? They finally reach a pair of iron gates. The gates remain firmly shut as they approach, so Chris leans out of his window and tries the intercom. He buzzes intermittently for 30 seconds or so, but there is no response. So perhaps Jack has seen them coming after all. Old Chris would have got back in the car and driven the perimeter of the property wall, looking for a way in, tutting all the while. But new Chris, slim, athletic Chris, starts to climb the gates instead. This brings Donna out of the car. He feels the pleasing burn of his muscles as he climbs, the gratifying response of muscles doing what they're told. He must look great, he thinks, just as he snags and rips his trousers on an iron spike. Donna climbs up after him at twice the speed, unhooks him, and they both clamber over the top of the gates and down onto Jack Mason's driveway. New security lights flick on with almost every step. Chris's trousers are ripped beyond repair, and Donna gets full sight of a pair of Homer Simpson boxer shorts. Honestly, says Donna, as the seat of Chris's trousers flaps in the wind. This is a perfect example of you being yourself. Did my mum choose those boxer shorts?
No, I forgot to take my washing out of the machine last night, says Chris. These are my emergency boxers. Let's just arrest Jack Mason, shall we?
As Chris walks up the driveway, Donna stoops to tie a shoelace.
He keeps walking until he hears a click. Donna, did you just take a photograph of my arse on your phone?
Me? No, says Donna, putting her phone back into her pocket.
The house itself soon appears, a silhouette in the halogen security lights. It is huge. Chris has never seen a private house this big. The only time you ever saw a house like this, it had a gift shop and a tea room. The wind is whistling around Chris's backside now. Perhaps Jack will have a sewing kit. Can you ask for a sewing kit when you've just arrested someone? As they climb the stone front steps to Jack Mason's front door, Chris makes sure he is a step behind Donna. As he reaches to press the baronial bell, he notices the door is ajar, light streaming through a small gap out into the night. He and Donna share a look. Donna pushes open the door, revealing the vast entrance hallway. There are sofas and side tables, portraits of men in wigs, a locked cabinet full of shotguns, a suit of armour on a plinth. And on the hallway carpet, the body of Jack Mason. Running, Donna reaches him first. He is on his back, a gunshot wound to the head. In his hand is a small gun. He is freezing cold and very dead. Donna starts to secure the scene as Chris calls it in. They will have a long wait with the body. Chris takes a closer look. That really is a very small gun. Chris tucks this thought away. You okay? He says to Donna. Of course I'm okay, says Donna. You? Chris looks down at the body. Yeah, I'm okay too. They're both okay, but they put an arm around each other regardless. Chris is thinking. The Thursday Murder Club starts looking into the Bethany Waits case, and before you know it, the two main suspects in her killing are dead. Hell of a coincidence. He glances at Donna. It looks like she's thinking the same thing.
I'm just thinking, says Donna, that we should really do something about your trousers before the circus arrives.
Chapter 68. Fiona Clements thought she had heard the last of Elizabeth Best, with her questions about Bethany Waits, with her accusations. How wrong she was. It was no secret that Fiona and Bethany hadn't got on. What of it? It doesn't mean you're going to drive someone off a cliff, does it? So what if Fiona hadn't cried on the tribute show? There had been two letters in the Evening Argus about it, which was the South-East-denied equivalent of a Twitter storm, but it meant nothing. Everyone cried at everything these days. You got rewarded for it. Fiona had pretended to cry at the BAFTAs, for example, and it had gone down very well. The Mail online headline had been TV Fiona turns on waterworks as she flaunts gym-honed body in figure-hugging dress. Does anyone ever actually cry for real, or is it always for attention? Her mum cried when her dad died, and within a week she was on a yacht with a dentist from her golf club, so spare us the histrionics. You could point the finger all you liked at Fiona, but you wouldn't get what you wanted. Fiona Clements is still trying to work out how Elizabeth got her number. Presumably her friend Joyce had tracked it down through her government contacts. Either way, the message had turned up last night. I wonder if you might be able to help us, dear. A few messages later, and Fiona knew the score. Does she trust Elizabeth and Joyce? No. Do they really know who killed Bethany Waits? Fiona doubts that very much. But will she help them? For reasons she can't quite access at the moment, yes, she probably will. Fiona is filming an advert for yogurt this morning, or for breakfast cereal, she forgets which. She knows she has to lick her famous lips and say, it's delicious, but she hasn't looked into it beyond that. She sits on a plastic chair in a cavernous studio as lights are adjusted and groups of men in glasses congregate scratching their beards while much younger people hand them coffees. Fiona is scrolling through her Instagram. 3.5 million followers now. She has promised her Instagram advisor, Luke, that she will post a story today. He is very strict with her, but seeing as she can get her £25,000 a time to post about a free holiday to the Maldives, she lets him be. But it's all very regimented and boring. She is a brand now, and everyone wants to tell her what to do, and worse, what not to do. Maybe she should push back against that a little. Next to her, a man dressed as a banana is eating a banana. She looks at the time, just gone 11 a.m. It's make your mind up time, Fiona. Elizabeth isn't asking for much in the grand scheme of things, but even so, Fiona has a number of objections. At first, she had told Elizabeth to speak to her agent. Oh, I don't think we'll be doing that, dear, do you? Elizabeth did her very best to persuade her. What's the worst that could happen? Elizabeth had said. Well, plenty is the truth. That's why Fiona remains in two minds. A woman dressed as a yogurt pot walks past, so it probably is an advert for yogurt. Fiona doesn't eat yogurt, ever since Gwyneth Paltrow once said something or other about it on TikTok. Was Fiona walking into some sort of trap? Should she just say no and have done with it? Why is she even entertaining the idea? Elizabeth and Joyce had fired all sorts of questions at her when they first met, and truth be told, Fiona had quite enjoyed it. Quite enjoyed being accused of murder by a woman who had pretended to faint and another woman with a revolver in her handbag. So if they want her help, sure, perhaps. Maybe it will make a splash at the very least. Everything is about new content, something new. Fiona wonders what the Mail Online headline will be this time. One of the men with glasses and a beard approaches her. Hi, Fiona, I'm Rory. We've just done the tiniest rewrite, and I wanted to check you'd be okay with us putting a dab of yogurt on your nose. We think it could really work, you know, for humour. Fiona gives Rory her full beam smile. I won't be putting yogurt on my nose, Rory. Rory nods. Yep, great. Let's do it without the yogurt on the nose. Love it. He disappears. The man dressed as a banana asks her for a selfie, and Fiona lets him know very gently that he is being unprofessional. She goes back to her phone and types out the information that Elizabeth has asked for. For the final time, she asks herself why. For fun, perhaps? For something new and interesting to do? To see how it all plays out, certainly. And maybe for Bethany? Fiona shakes her head. She is not the sentimental type. She is doing it for followers. That must be the explanation. She presses send. The deed is done. Chapter 69. Chris is having trouble hearing what Andrew Everton is saying. The room is very busy and there is excited chatter all around. People are drinking on a weekday evening and the air is heavy with that heady thrill. As they make their way to the table, Andrew Everton speaks directly into his ear. Suicide? Look like it, says Chris. I don't trust anything connected with this case, says Andrew Everton. A friend of yours came to visit me. Oh, yes, says Chris, back into Andrew Everton's ear. A woman named Elizabeth, says Andrew Everton. No surprises there. Sorry about her, says Chris, as they reach their table. Not at all, says Andrew Everton. Chris searches for his name card. He is next to Patrice, thank goodness. Sometimes they split couples up with these things. She has a job for me. That sounds like Elizabeth, says Chris. I can trust her? He asks. God, no,
says Chris, but his laugh says otherwise, and Andrew Everton nods. Chris pulls Patrice's chair out for her, and she sits.
I could get used to this, says Patrice to Andrew Everton. Who does Chris have to arrest to get invited back next year?
Andrew Everton laughs. Chris and Donna will both be receiving a highly commended in the line of duty medal. They are gold-plated. Terry Hallett has one and has shown Chris pictures. Andrew Everton addresses Chris and Patrice.
Do you want to see the medal?
Go on, then, says Patrice.
Teachers don't see medals very often. Andrew Everton reaches into a pocket and pulls out a small velvet pouch. He opens a drawstring and pulls out the gold medal inside.
Worth a few bob on eBay, that, says Patrice. She squeezes Chris's hand.
Across from them are two empty chairs. Donna is bringing Bogdan. She had to come clean in the end. Polish cinema, indeed. Patrice has yet to meet him, but she has just seen photos and, as far as Chris is concerned, is a little too enthusiastic. Bogdan is making Donna very happy, though, and that is Chris's only concern. Patrice kisses him.
You excited?
Never won anything before, says Chris.
My heart, says Patrice.
I can't put your heart in my downstairs loo to show off to visitors, can I? Says Chris.
You excited about meeting Bogdan?
Oh, my God, says Patrice. So excited.
Again, a little over-enthusiastic. Chris suspects that Bogdan would be a tough stepson-in-law to match. A lot of weddings needed before that happened, though. Well, two weddings.
Stop thinking about weddings, Chris. Say something to impress Andrew Everton.
I haven't had a Toblerone for 3 months now.
Is that so?
Says Andrew Everton. Jesus, Chris. The compere, a comedian Chris has seen on TV, Josh something, kicks things off with a monologue. He's very funny, ripping into everyone and dealing with the drunken heckles that come his way. Chris sees Donna making her way through the side door of the grand ballroom. She is alone. Uh-oh. Both he and Patrice watch as she makes her way over and sits, her face like a cliff in a dark storm. An empty chair beside her.
No Bogdan? Asks Chris.
Elizabeth needed him, says Donna.
Well, quite a theme was developing. Was something going on they didn't know about?
Part 3. Catch up on all the news. Chapter 70. Joyce. I am in Staffordshire. We all are, pretty much. Everyone who needs to be, at least. Elizabeth and Stephen are here. They are down the hallway, though they haven't emerged yet this morning. Ron and Pauline are in the east wing. This house has wings. Ibrahim drove them, and he's staying at the gatehouse at the end of the drive. Henrik is here, naturally. It is his house. It's like Downton Abbey, but with a pinball machine and a hot tub. Mike Waghorn is also here. I suggested he join us for a brandy in the library last night, but he wanted an early night, as we have given him a job to do today. He is taking it seriously. In the end, it was just me and Ibrahim sitting up, drinking and chatting. He is feeling very perky because he has cracked the identity of Karen Whitehead. He worked it out in the car on the way up here. When he told me, I double-checked and triple-checked, but he was quite right. He really can be very clever. I'm still taking credit for Michael Gullis, though. That's what really cracked the case. I told Joanna I had worked it out, and she said, well done, and sounded like she meant it. There was even a thumbs-up emoji. As for Robert Brown, MSc, we are still none the wiser, but it doesn't matter so much now. I'm sure we will work it out sooner or later. Stephen had been given a guided tour of the library when he arrived. He looked like a boy,
eyes wide, smile even wider. The years dropped away from him. Victor is having breakfast in his room and making notes for later. Interesting to see how he plans these things out. Andrew Everton is on his way up too. It was the Kent Police Awards last night and he couldn't miss it. They were giving Chris and Donna a commendation. I saw it on Donna's Instagram. I think Bogdan should probably have him with her, but he had to drive Elizabeth and Stephen up here. I wonder if Donna minded. No one else seems to have spotted their dating, but Pauline and I had a quiet gossip about it earlier. Donna certainly wasn't smiling in the photographs. One person who isn't here is Fiona Clements, but that's not to say she isn't involved. Alan has stayed at home. I make that sound as if it was his choice, as if he had a few things he wanted to catch up on. If we are all up here in Staffordshire, who is looking after him, you ask? There is a new resident in the village. He is called Mervyn, and he is Welsh. I have always had a soft spot for the Welsh. He used to be the headmaster of a school. You can tell that too, strict but fair. Grey hair, dark moustache. You know the look. Don't mind if I do. I have shown him to Pauline at a distance and got a thumbs up. I thought Pauline might have got a little upset about the way I questioned her at our afternoon tea, but not a bit of it. I suppose she just wanted the truth to come out as much as the rest of us. Now, Mervyn has a cairn terrier called Rosie, and we bumped into each other a couple of days ago on a walk. Alan sniffed around Rosie, and I dare say if Alan were asked, he'd tell you I sniffed around Mervyn too. Long, short story, we got chatting, and the same afternoon I dropped around a cherry bakewell for him, just to say welcome to the village. Mervyn is going to feed and walk Alan while I'm gone. I told him I would be very grateful, and he gave me a little smile. And before you ask, yes, Mervyn is heterosexual. He's had two wives and five kids, and there was a Top Gear DVD on one of his shelves. We should only be here for 24 hours or so unless something goes very wrong. Which reminds me, I must make sure that Ibrahim moves his car round to the back of the house. Bogdan didn't need telling. His is hidden away. We're planning to kick off at about midday. I think everyone knows what they're doing. I don't really have a role as such. I just get to watch. Which I think I've earned, given I worked out who murdered Bethany Wade's. Very soon the whole world will know. I gave Mervyn my phone number, you know, in case you want to send me a picture of Alan. But so far he hasn't used it. I keep checking, but nothing. Chapter 71. It was an indignity to be dumped at the gates in a blindfold. But if that's the price of entry, so be it. Paranoia is to be expected. The approach to the house is magnificent. Long gravel, driveway, topiary hedges, fountains, statues of lions. But today there are no staff tending to it. No gardeners or chauffeurs poking their noses in, able to tell what they've seen. It's exactly as was promised. Looking up at windows ahead, no movement there either. You have to allow for the possibility that this is a trap, but thus far it doesn't look like one. The house itself is too big, way too big, if this man, the Viking, lives here alone. Given the secrecy involved in this whole operation, and given the monosyllabic nature of their email exchanges, that's a fair bet. It will be just the two of them. And it will have to be played exactly right. Get what you've come for and go. Not easy, not easy at all, but the rewards will be worth it. A push on the bell, and the sound of it reverberates deep inside this lonely house. How much would the Viking have paid for this place? 20 million? At least. Footsteps approach, and the huge oak front door opens. There he is,
the man himself. What is he? 6'6"? Huge beard, Foo Fighters t-shirt clinging to a huge torso. An offered hand, a shake.
You must be the Viking.
And you, says the Viking, must be Andrew Everton. Let me take you to my library. Andrew Everton follows the huge figure through a marble entrance hall and into a carpeted corridor. Every wall is covered in art, most of it too modern for the chief constable's taste, but the odd sailing ship or Norman church here and there make up for it. The Viking leads him into a library, a cocoon of dark wood and red leather and soft lighting. Andrew Everton thinks about the sign on his office wall. Crime doesn't pay. We'll see about that. The Viking gestures to the walls, lined from floor to ceiling with books. Are you a reader, Chief Constable?
Love writing books more than reading them, if I'm honest, says Andrew Everton, and sits in an armchair indicated by his host. We can probably skip all this chat if you'd rather. It's a lovely house, it was a pleasant journey, I don't need the loo, and I'm okay for water.
The Viking nods.
Okay.
He sits and nearly fills a two-seater leather sofa and switches on a lamp beside him.
What do you need from me, Mr. Andrew Everton?
Chapter 72. Joyce. The lamp is the key to the whole thing. Once you switch it on, you switch on the cameras and microphones. We're all in the staff kitchen at the back of the house, quiet as church mice, and now we can see the live images from inside the library. We can't see Henrik because he didn't want to be on camera because of his criminal empire, not because he is shy, although he is also quite shy, I think. By the way, I checked my crypto account the other day, and it's now worth £56,000, so thank you, Henrik. Andrew Everton looks very sure of himself, has no idea of what he is walking into. Elizabeth gave him a tip-off. Absolutely between us, Andrew. About the Viking, the money launderer who's been trying to kill us. I can get you a meeting. Don't ask me how, and don't ask me where, just thank me. Perhaps you could pay him a visit? And paying him a visit is exactly what Andrew Everton is doing now. Not to gather evidence, not to arrest him, but simply because he is a man in great need of a money launderer. Because Andrew Everton was the brains behind the VAT fraud. Andrew Everton killed Bethany Waits and blackmailed Jack Mason and Heather Garbutt into silence. In his book, Given in Evidence, I think I told you about it, the main character is a gangland boss called Big Mick, and Big Mick's full name? Michael Gullis. A silly error very early on in the scam. We all make mistakes. And in case you're wondering if it might be a coincidence, the name of the other early payee also crops up in one of Andrew Everton's books. I told you Ibrahim cracked Karen Whitehead. It was simple, really. It's an anagram of Catherine Howard, the teak tough detective. Clever Ibrahim. So our guess was that Andrew Everton, so far unable to unlock any of the proceeds of the fraud, might like to have a private chat with the Viking. And that private chat is what we are watching right now. Chapter 73.
I'm a police officer, says Andrew Everton. You understand that, of course.
I understand, says the Viking. So long as you are not filming me or recording me, we are cool.
Likewise, says Andrew Everton. Though, if you are taping me, not a single word of it would be admissible in court anyway, so you'd be wasting your time.
No one is taping anyone, says the Viking. That's not how I work.
You said you need my help. Andrew Everton leans forward.
I have £10 million in various accounts around the world. I currently have no way of retrieving it without questions. I am hoping you might be able to help me.
£10 million. Yes, easy, says the Viking. What's in it for me?
Half a million, says Andrew Everton.
The Viking laughs. And a chief constable on your payroll. You look after me, I look after you. The Viking nods. I need to know where the money is from. Some money I won't touch.
A VAT fraud from about 10 years ago. Mobile phones in and out of Dover. Easy money.
Your idea? Asks the Viking.
Guilty, says Andrew Everton. I was writing a book. I write for my sins. And I came up with a scheme, just a plot, really. But the more I thought about it, I realised, you know what? I'm not going to put it in the book. I'm going to do it for real.
Clever.
Well, sometimes I use real crimes for my plots. This time, I use one of my plots for a real crime.
How did you do it? Asks the Viking.
I wasn't a chief constable back then, but I knew a few people. Talked to a man called Jack Mason. Ran all sorts of dodgy enterprises, but he was always